Welcome to Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy practitioner. I'm your host, Holly Waymont. I work for UT Health San Antonio's Department of Pediatrics. In this podcast, we explore how we can provide the best, most cutting-edge, compassionate care for children. We hope to give you a unique and behind-the-scenes edge from our expert guests. After listening, click on the link on this podcast for free credit that may include CME, MOC, or ethics credit, depending on the topic. Joining me back on the show today is Dr. Ed Brooks. He's Division Chief of Allergy, Immunology, and Infectious Disease at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. He also has 30 years of experience in this field. And Dr. Brooks, you were on a national panel that set these type of guidelines.
That's correct. Yeah, it went on for several years.
Thank you so much for being back here on the show. First off, I'm getting questions from pediatricians. What are these guidelines? What is the most important thing to know first?
Well, it's an update to the national guidelines, so it's not a total revision of the guidelines. So the previous guidelines that most people have been following are perfectly fine. There's nothing inherently wrong. The big change is that we've instituted use of inhaled corticosteroids as needed, as opposed to on a standard schedule, which again is perfectly fine. But it appears that if you use inhaled steroids as needed during certain situations, it's a superior way to control asthma. And the specific circumstances that the guidelines addressed were in children with intermittent but severe episodes of asthma, particularly with viral infections. It's now been studied and appears to be superior to using inhaled bronchodilators such as albuterol alone to add inhaled steroids along with it. And those studies used a liquid inhaled steroid called budesonide, and they used it twice a day during the exacerbation, and it showed some improvement in those severe exacerbations. And these are, again, children with mild intermittent, meaning they don't have symptoms other than during viral infections. So that's a big change. The other is something called smart therapy, in which a combination inhaler, and most of the studies were done with the inhaled steroid budesonide plus formoterol, which is long-acting bronchodilator. However, the difference with salmeterol, which is in the product Advair, which has a longer onset, the formoterol has a very short onset of action, therefore can be used as needed in place of albuterol or a short-acting bronchodilator. The guidelines now recommend that someone with moderate persistent asthma can use the combination once or twice a day, but then in addition, when they have symptoms, instead of using albuterol, it was shown to be very superior to use the combination inhaler as needed. And in children under 12, the guidelines would recommend up to a total of 8 inhalations a day or 8 puffs a day. And for older than 12 years old, up to 12 puffs a day. And the outcomes were extremely significant for reduction of exacerbations requiring hospitalizations or oral corticosteroids. Now, one of the things that people were concerned about, oh, will they get a lot more of that medication and therefore use a lot more inhaled steroid? It turns out in the comparative trials, people did not use excess inhaler and actually used a lot less of the inhaled steroid in addition to not requiring oral steroids. So the overall exposure to corticosteroids was less using what we call SMART therapy, which stands for single maintenance and reliever therapy. That's probably the biggest sort of, I'll say, psychological change. Why that is because we, for years, have used inhaled steroids on a schedule once or twice a day, and then as needed bronchodilators. Using as needed inhaled steroids has not been FDA approved in this country. However, the Guidelines Committee and NHLBI are working with the FDA to allow people to get, sometimes you may have a bad month, you may run out of that inhaler, that's another concern. And so they're working with that, as well as working with school districts in which children have always had a rescue inhaler, albuterol, and convincing everyone that if they use their combination inhaler. So the two inhalers that are marketed in this country that would fit this therapy are, one is called, it's a budesonide and formoterol, and that's marketed under the name Symbicort, and there's generic. And there's also mometasone formoterol, which is marketed under the name Dulera, and again, there's generics of that. And so getting a child two inhalers is still a bit tricky. It's tricky in terms of insurance coverage to make sure all the insurers will actually cover an additional inhaler if they need it. Again, the research suggests that they'll actually end up using less. And so a general approach would be prescribing, and when, the way they did the studies, prescribing the inhaler one puff once a day for mild asthma, mild persistent asthma, or up to two puffs twice a day on a regular schedule. And in addition, using, again, up to eight puffs total in children under 12, or up to 12 puffs extra, 12 puffs total in older children and adults during exacerbations of their asthma.
Which it might, with children under 12 especially, it might be hard to keep track of during the school day how many puffs he or she has had.
Right, right. And toxicities were very low. And there's been some concern about using that plus additional albuterol. But again, there really were no concerns in the multiple studies that were reviewed of toxicity. And in general, as I said, they end up using less of the medication. And the theoretical background to why that is because the combination, the two medications delivered together have a synergistic effect. So it has an amplified benefit, and it's borne out in the data, particularly with regard to frequency of exacerbations and severity of exacerbation. Again, they're together in the same inhaler.
Okay.
Already. So you don't have to take two different inhalers.
Now, okay.
This topic has come up as well, where patients have been on an inhaled steroid and a bronchodilator, and additional research has come out since the guidelines, and it's shown that's also as effective. In other words, if they're taking fluticasone, let's say two puffs once or twice a day, and then they need the extra albuterol, it seems to be effective to use albuterol plus additional fluticasone. So you're adding additional inhaled steroid to the regimen. And so one easy way to train your patients is every time you use albuterol, use your Flovent, just match it puff for puff. And that seems to give, again, a similar synergy of the effect. And again, obviating, hopefully, the need for oral steroids or emergency room visits or hospitalizations.
Well, you know, the saying less is more, and taking two at once, so there's more in there, but then it turns out to be less because you need less because it's more effective.
Correct. Children stay under better control and their episodes are shortened, and where they don't need to continue taking high doses of the medication for a prolonged period of time.
What would be some symptoms pediatric practitioners can tell the parents, you know, that their children, and tell the children, this is, if you're feeling this, this, and this, it's time for another puff?
If they're having cough, it seems to be relieved by the albuterol. Many reasons for cough, one of which is asthma, but many children, their primary symptom is coughing. If they're coughing when they're running and playing, exercising is a common trigger for asthma, then they need to increase the inhaler frequency. And of course, coughing at nighttime, in the middle of the night, children with asthma wake up in, you know, middle of the night, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and have a cough, 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 as opposed to simply clearing their throat. And those are the early warning signs of asthma. And so there's two ways we classify the severity of asthma. One is how the chronicity of it, and that In other words, how often are they having symptoms during the week with exercise, with at nighttime? And the other is what we call the risk domain, in which they're at risk for having severe exacerbations. So I'll go back to the example I mentioned about children with viral infections that have severe exacerbations that end up in the hospital. And in between, they're perfectly fine. They have no symptoms, no warning signs of asthma at all. And so this is a classic phenotype of very young children who are very sensitive to some viruses that trigger asthma. And so using, again, the inhaled steroids during the periods where they have their viral episodes is very effective at reducing the severity of those episodes. In the past, we might have reclassified them as persistent asthma and recommended they take inhaled steroids all the time. And one of the parameters, we used to use the rules of two. If you have more than two episodes per week of cough or wheeze, if you have more than two episodes at nighttime with coughing or wheezing, or if you have more than two episodes of exacerbations in a year that require oral steroids, we might, even though in between they're perfectly fine, we would reclassify them as, quote, persistent asthma, and then treat them with daily inhaled steroids. Well, with the new guidelines, basically, regardless of how we end up classifying them, you know, if they beat the rules of two by the two severe exacerbations a year requiring steroids, but the rest of the year they don't require anything, then it makes sense to treat them with inhaled steroids during those episodes to avoid the use of systemic steroids or oral steroids, which we know have long-term side effects.
What are some of those long-term side effects?
Well, you know, when a child's on a course of oral steroids, they don't grow. So the growth inhibition is the biggest concern. And inhaled steroids in higher doses can also have a similar effect. So the least amount of corticosteroids we expose them to, the better. The other is risk of fractures and osteoporosis. They have an effect on that, and some studies have shown with five or more courses of oral steroids in a year, a child is at higher risk of having fractures. There are some more what we call idiosyncratic or rare side effects of cataracts. Obviously, elevated blood glucose in children who are pre-diabetic is also a concern. And again, it's worse with oral steroids than with inhaled steroids.
And is it because the inhaled steroids are going right to where the irritation is happening?
I think that's part of the explanation. The synergy between the two, the beta agonist and the corticosteroid, seems to have a more beneficial effect on relieving bronchospasm and airway inflammation.
So, and I know you mentioned toxicity, so it's got to be stressful having a child who has asthma. And then on top of it, with everything else you're trying to keep track of, work and home and kids, and then if you can't remember if your child has already had eight puffs and he or she's under 12, is it a big deal if they have a ninth one and you can't remember? Or do you want to say anything there?
Again, the data in all the studies didn't show any toxicities. They chose these numbers to do their clinical trials. Mm-hmm. So they didn't go higher, but that's why the recommendations come down on these. So I personally don't think it's a big deal to go extra, but guidelines are guidelines.
It sounds like it's pretty complicated, but then kind of when you put it, as you're saying, bottom line, then it isn't that much to keep track of.
It's actually much easier, in my opinion. I've been doing this approach for many years. And basically, the concept is if you have two inhalers, a rescue and a controller inhaler, again, we've had it beat into our brain that controllers you use regularly and the rescue medicine you use as needed. So I think we're just unlearning what we've been learning for the last decade or two. So with a combination inhaler, you have one inhaler, single inhaler. You don't have to worry about a second inhaler. That in of itself is simple. and you tell them, okay, you're going to take this inhaler once a day or twice a day. And then when you have a flare up, just use the same inhaler as often as you need it. And, you know, try to keep track of the number, total numbers of puffs. You know, if they're doing a single puff at a time, then, you know, 12 puffs a day, you'd have to be doing it, you know, pretty often without any benefit. And in that situation, you probably need to go to the emergency room anyway. And that those are the guidelines. If you reach that 12, then, or 8 in the younger kids, then you probably ought to be seeing your physician anyway. Because it's not 100%. Some exacerbations are severe and that you need to seek medical care. But for the most part, again, just using that. And again, I just sort of say, well, before sports, use your inhaler. You have one inhaler to remember. That's it. And so in that respect, it is simpler.
And again, it's up to 8 puffs, recommended 12 and under, and up to 12 puffs if you're over 12.
Correct.
So, and do you recommend always before athletics, say if a child's going into PE, taking a dose, even if they're not, he or she isn't coughing?
No, I don't.
Okay.
In fact, that's one of the questions I ask the patients. I say, well, when you go out and play or do something, do you cough or have trouble every single time? Because it's a good feedback for me. And if the answer is no, then no, you don't have to use it pre-exercise.
One of our pediatric listeners for Pediatrics Now was asking, what about when there are medication shortages? What do you do then?
All inhaled steroids are about equal. So if a child is on an inhaled steroid, it doesn't matter. Same with the bronchodilator products. They're all equal. And so if you're on one of these combination inhalers and there's a shortage, you just revert back to the 2 inhaler system. And again, you can use it the same way. Use your controller inhaler, you know, once or twice a day, and then use the combination as much as you need it. Again, follow the same guidelines about 8 and 12 puffs. And that's been shown to be more effective than only using albuterol alone. That's the only change. The only change is instead of albuterol alone, you're using 2 inhalers each time you need a rescue inhalation.
And is it fewer doses a day, though, or that has not changed? It has been as needed, a couple doses?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that hasn't changed because you base that on how chronic their symptoms are. And if a child is having daily symptoms, well, you're going to dose the daily regimen higher and you're going to increase the constant, you know, so that many of these come in different concentrations of inhaled steroid. So you're going to increase the inhaled steroid based on their chronicity to try to get their asthma under control.
Okay. This question is from Acorn Pediatrics. The doctors there are saying, please clarify management of asthma exacerbation for children on controller therapy, especially if on LABA, LABA?
The LABA is that bronchodilator that's long-acting bronchodilator agents. So there's two classes of them. And this is the tricky part, because one of the original combination inhaler was fluticasone and salmeterol. Now, salmeterol you cannot use in SMART therapy because it takes 2 to 3 hours before the full benefit of the bronchodilator. And so it's not a rescue medicine in the least bit. It is only for daily chronic management. And so people who are on Advair or the fluticasone-salmeterol combination would take it 1 or 2 puffs, 1 or 2 times a day. And if they have exacerbation, they use as needed albuterol. Now, the other two products, the budesonide formoterol, is the difference between the formoterol and salmeterol, have a rapid onset of action. So you can use it as if it was your rescue inhaler. And that's where SMART therapy is really beneficial.
We walk us through what would be important not to miss saying to a family.
The biggest danger is if they're on Advair. They cannot use Advair beyond what the physician's prescribed. And one of the dangers is they use the Advair or the salmeterol fluticasone combination regularly, and then they try to use it as needed and it doesn't work. So they turn around and give them albuterol because it does work rapidly. Well, after 2 to 3 hours, that Advair kicks in and you can get combined toxicities of the beta agonist. It's usually not as big a problem in children who have healthy hearts, but in adults with heart disease, that can be a real risk. The beta agonist can have some effects on the heart, tachycardia, et cetera.
Okay, so bottom line with Advair, only use that if that's the only way and only as prescribed?
Only as prescribed. It should be one or two puffs once or twice a day.
And not as needed.
Right. You cannot use it as needed. The other products you can use as needed.
A 12 and a half year old boy, Benjamin, is seeing his pediatrician. The mom is in the clinic with them. The asthma seems to be getting worse. And walk us through what we should say based on the new guidelines.
Well, it depends on what's getting worse. If they're having higher frequency of symptoms throughout the week, then one would increase their baseline therapy. So they might increase the dose of the inhaled steroid. That would be the most effective approach. Or the frequency, the numbers of inhalations. Let's say he was on one puff a day of Flovent and then PRN albuterol, but he's having a lot of symptoms. One approach would be, well, increase the Flovent to two puffs twice a day, or increase the dose from Flovent 44 to Flovent 110. There's three different doses of Flovent. Those would all be appropriate. If, on the other hand, he was doing mostly fine, but every month or so he was having a severe exacerbation that ended up in the ER, and they ended up on oral steroids. In that case, I would institute SMART therapy, and I would use one of the other products. You could either have them on Flovent and just say, just use Flovent each time you use your albuterol. And I, for simplicity, say, just match it puff for puff. In other words, if you give him two puffs of albuterol, give him two puffs of the extra of Flovent every time he needs it. And that's particularly important in children who are using albuterol or short-acting beta agonist very frequently. If they're using it very frequently, that's a risk, because there's a risk of something called tachyphylaxis. In other words, the beta agonist receptor will downregulate and the albuterol become less and less effective. And that's the advantage, again, of the combination with the inhaled steroid, is it protects you from that downregulation. So they again, that's part of this, the physiologic synergy between the two medications. The other approach would say, okay, stop taking that. We're going to put you on budesonide and formoterol combination. Use that inhaler, one puff twice a day, and then as needed in between for the exacerbations or for your worsening symptoms.
So say Benjamin's cousin, who's 8, Sarah, her asthma is not getting worse, but does she need to come in and the pediatrician should talk to that family about the new guidelines, like call that family and schedule a time for them to come in?
If they're doing well on the current regimen, there's really no reason to rock the boat. I would say if they're doing well on their current regimen, there's really no reason to change it.
And so when talking to patients, is it more saying, we have these new guidelines, would you like to hear them? It's not like we need to talk to every patient who has asthma about these new guidelines.
Yeah, I don't do that. And of course, it depends on how much people want to hear.
Right.
Sometimes, keeping it simple is the best approach. And if a child's doing well on it, let's say they're on Flovent, two puffs twice a day, and they're doing great. They occasionally use albuterol with sports, maybe once a week or every other week. They need a little albuterol. They get a virus and need albuterol for a day or two. I'm not sure I would change much at that point. It's primarily focused on those. And a more typical scenario is the teenagers who never take medication regularly, right?
Right.
And you have a teenager. And you say, take your nasal spray every day. Well, they just don't do it. Most people don't do that. They use medication when they need it. And that's where I think the underlying advantage of smart therapy is. I put every teenager on it because they don't take medicine unless they need it. With the bronchodilator mixed in with the inhaled steroid, they use it. You never have to train a teenager to use albuterol. They will use it and use it and use it and overuse it because it gives them relief immediately. They get immediate benefit. And so you're sneaking the steroid in on the side, which you don't feel it working. So that's one of the advantages, is that probably a lot of people back off or skip their medication. I know they do because I ask them if they do. And some of them haven't taken it in months and their parents think they're taking it regularly. So they know the answer on the test. They just, you know, it's hard to get an honest answer out of it. But when they need it, they will use it. And whatever motivates them to use the inhaled steroid is a win, because they won't use it at all because they don't feel it working.
Okay. And for kids under 12 or kids in school in general, should the nurse be informed that, you know, if the child asks to be excused from class to be able to take this medication anytime to be able to do it?
I think so. I mean, I'm not sure where all the schools, there's a sort of a diversity of responses out there in the schools. And they pretty much want to control, in the younger kids, particularly in the elementary and middle schools, in the high schools, because it's a state law that they can carry their own inhaler. Some kids tell me, oh, I just carry it with me and nobody ever says anything. So it's some always go to the school nurse and have to keep their inhaler with the school nurse, and some carry it with them. So there's kind of it's all over the place. And I believe whatever works, I mean, I understand the schools want to keep control of medication use during school time, but at the same time, it's a state law that they can carry their inhaler with them.
Okay. And it may vary from state to state. So check your state law for listeners out of state or in other countries.
Correct. I don't know what all the laws are. I know in Texas, you know, they can carry their own inhaler.
Any other advice about the new asthma guidelines you'd like to give to pediatricians?
Well, there are a couple other areas that we address. You know, I mentioned what I think is the most dramatic change. One is with environmental controls and with people with allergic asthma. And the guy that studied a lot of investigations into doing things in the home that might make a difference in reducing allergen exposure. And so basically, if you have allergies to molds and insects, things like that, you know, like mites, then just getting a dust cover for the bed is not enough. You have to use what we call comprehensive allergy control. And it goes from mold mitigation to insect mitigation to, you know, the covers on the beds and reducing the humidity in the home, comprehensive things. We don't recommend the air filters. I know those get I get a lot of questions about the air filters, and they basically have not shown any benefit for people with allergic disease. And the main reason is, most of the allergens are very heavy and they're not floating in the air. It's only if you vacuum and kick it up in the air that you might notice that. I think there may be two situations in which air filters may be a benefit, and that's with cat dander, which has a very high buoyancy, and so it floats in the air quite a bit, and mold spores also. But the main mitigation for mold is get rid of the water, the dampness, because mold can't grow without water. And so you don't have to rip out walls and clean out air filters or clean out air ducts, things of that nature, and all these expensive solutions that just haven't been shown to be beneficial. Doing the simple things makes it. Insects, allergy, you know, cockroach allergy, things like that. Just doing cockroach control, and again, comprehensive insect control, and not, or what they call it, what's the term they use, universal or comprehensive? Basically, don't use insecticides.
Universal.
Yeah, don't use insecticides. Use roach motels and, you know, get rid of the food crumbs and things like that, because the insecticides themselves have a toxic effect and can actually worsen allergies and asthma. So you want to avoid using I always call them poisons. Don't put poison in your home.
And or even outside of your home.
Yeah, I'm just not a big fan of poisons anywhere for pets and small children, you know, get into stuff like that. The other two areas that were addressed during the expert panel were the use of exhaled nitric oxide. And this really impacts mostly the specialists, but basically you can't really use that as a criteria for diagnosing asthma, but its effect is helpful for monitoring asthma progress over time. But it, as a single modality, it's really not very specific for asthma. It's not good in that context. The other is use of immunotherapy or allergy shots for children with asthma or people with asthma. And it was a positive. The studies show that there's a positive effect of controlling allergic disease with allergy shots in controlling asthma.
Okay.
And I sort of gave a short answer for those, but like I said, I think most of the changes people are affected by who are not a specialist are going to be the use of inhaled steroids as needed.
And thank you so much. This has been so insightful. It helps so much. And it helps to really hear you talk about the asthma guidelines as opposed to reading it. It looks really complicated.
Yeah. You know, the wording of it is, and it's, you know, very detailed and scientific and specific. The guidelines process is shifted and we have to adhere to very strict statistical outcomes. And so only certain clinical trials get included in the reviews. And like this information for SMART therapy, that's been around for a couple of decades, you know, where people were doing some non-controlled clinical trials, but only a few of them that were done, quote, the right way got included in the reviews. So that's why the reviews are very kind of narrow in their scope, so to speak. And a lot of people were upset with that, but that's the process. In the National NHLBI, National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, they adhere to these very strict things because they don't want to have to backtrack. And there have been some mistakes in the past in the guidelines when they made recommendations and then had to backtrack because the evidence really wasn't there. And so I have to be very careful about that. But general principles are inhaled steroids work great. And like, here's something I tell my patients: when your allergies are really bad, you know, the FDA said, you know, people are going to prescribe Flonase like once or twice a day. I say use it 4 or 5 times a day if it's really bad, slam it and then back off. And that works really well. And a lot of people will tell me, oh, that stuff doesn't work. Well, they're not using it enough. If you're snotty, you put it in your nose, then you blow your nose, it's gone. And I say you can't overdose. I mean, yes, there's side effects of corticosteroids, but you can't even come near to what the side effects are of taking oral prednisone. So It's always, I think topical steroids are always safer than oral steroids. And the old guidelines lean heavily on oral steroids as a last resort, but it happened a lot because when you have an exacerbation, you need to ramp it up fast. And so again, going back to SMART, it gives patients the tools to treat those exacerbations and not have to end up in the ER and not end up on oral steroids. And I think getting high doses of topical steroids is as effective as taking prednisone. And so that information has been around for a long time. The committee did not address acute exacerbation of asthma with inhaled steroids, even though that was one of the outcome measures. Because some studies have suggested that, well, if you just use tons of inhaled steroid and compare that to prednisone, it's about the same. And the side effects are much less. So I think people need to not be afraid of inhaled steroids or nasal steroids. And antihistamines just don't have any long-term prophylactic benefit. So in general, what I see is everybody takes antihistamines all the time.
Even for a cold, when that it could be opening the body up for a secondary infection, right?
Indirectly, you're right. They've studied mostly otitis media and shown that, for one, antihistamines don't have any benefit And some of the studies actually show a risk of persistent, what we call serosotitis. Now, and the way I think about it, antihistamines dry things up. So it look, makes it look good on the outside, but the natural healing process is to drain all that stuff out, the sinuses, the ears, the lungs. Their natural mechanism for staying healthy is they produce mucus and you just wash all the gunk away and keep the bacteria washed out and the viruses, et cetera. And if you slow that process down, you're going to be more prone to getting sinus infections and ear infections. So I think overuse of the over-the-counter medications would tend to be even more drying. And the decongestants, when you just need to get in bed and drink and get chicken soup, in my opinion.
Right.
And for a cold, distinguishing a cold from allergies is really, really difficult, but very important for pediatricians to know. So one thing, if they have fever, it's not allergy. It's got to be an infection. Allergies do not cause fever. And a lot of people say, well, I have seasonal allergies. And I'll say, what season? Well, they can't tell me because it's off and on all year. And typically in the fall and winter, when that's the cold and virus season, when the kids go back to school, that's when we get all the colds and viruses. And I'll say, well, how long do your allergies last? Oh, about a week. And they'll say, with the weather change and something blew in and then it goes away completely. I said, that was probably a cold. We are, if you're around kids, young kids, you are showered with viruses all the time. I can pull a virus out of a kid's nose all the time, no matter what.
Right.
Even if they're healthy, there's always a virus in there.
Really? Even teenagers?
Well, we did a study with kids with asthma. We didn't, they were mostly younger children, you know, sort of school age kids and, you know, middle schoolers. I don't know if we had too many high schoolers, but every time we stuck a swab up their nose, there was a virus, no matter whether they're healthy or sick or otherwise.
There's
a virus in there all the time. Whether we catch a cold is a function of the immune system. And of course, we had to relearn this with COVID. You know, people were healthy and fine, and yet they test positive for COVID and could pass it on. And that's the viruses being smart. It's like, well, we don't want to really make people sick, but we want to propagate. We want to spread. We want to reproduce. But how the immune system handles that virus, and that's how the vaccine works. People say, well, it doesn't prevent. And people get upset because it doesn't prevent COVID. It's like, well, no, it just keeps you from dying from it.
Right.
The more important thing is you catch it. And so it's the same with all the viruses. Chickenpox. When I was young, we all got chickenpox and we had immunity the rest of our life. That immunity has waned because there's no more chickenpox out there.
And that's why we have to worry about shingles?
Shingles, exactly, because the immune system now has gone to sleep. And it's every year we would get hit with chickenpox as it spread everywhere. And that has a boosting effect. So natural immunity was always there. So the kids go through the first year of school, they're just sick as heck. And then after that, they, quote, don't catch the viruses. Well, they get the viruses. They just kill it. And occasionally we get a new strain, a strong one like COVID that comes along and our immune system hadn't seen it before. But they did a recent study with COVID and found that some children who showed immunity to the common cold coronavirus had developed some immunity to COVID. And so the cross reaction, so it's a coronavirus, and so there's some components of it that are similar to the common cold. And so, but those antibodies added some degree of protection against COVID. So bugs are, you know, they're part of our life. We're surrounded, we're swimming in bugs and critters and viruses.
And do we all have that in our nasal passages, or do we just know that kids do?
I think it's less so. Mm-hmm. You know, the least exposure you have to crowds and kids, you know, there's less exposure, which represents somewhat of a risk because your immunity, if you're not exposed at all, once you do finally catch or get exposed to somebody, then we're more likely to be sick with it if our immunity has waned. But like you said about shingles, that's probably true. Our immune systems have gone to sleep because we haven't been exposed to it in such a long time. that the virus lives in our nerve roots if we had chicken pox. And once everybody gets exposed to chicken pox at some point, and it lives in our nerve roots, and then it can come out and cause shingles. But that never, and it's happening in kids. It never happened before. So it's much higher rate of shingles than we used to ever see.
Right now, there's a higher rate of shingles in children. I didn't know children got shingles.
Yeah, I didn't either until they started getting it.
Well, when did that happen?
Again, and this is in the last decade since the vaccine has cut down on the wild virus floating around. People don't get boosted. So now they're recommending a booster for the chickenpox vaccine. CDC and, you know, the health agencies, you know, put all their heads together and come up with these guidelines. And I think it's reasonable to, you know, protect against. And when now, and adults, of course, get the Shingrix, which is basically the adult chickenpox vaccine to help protect against shingles. And that's just, again, it's just boosting the immune system because we don't have any natural immunity to boost against anymore. There's very little chickenpox out there anymore.
Does the shingles look different? Do you want to talk about that? Just one other thing just to add to our pediatrician listeners. Would that look different in a child? What do you look for?
It's the same as an adult. You get in a particular dermatome and comes out of the nerve roots, and it's, you know, the blistering, and it's extremely painful. Mm-hmm. It's very different from chickenpox because it's embedded in the nerve roots and it comes out in the nerves. And so it irritates the nerves. It's very painful. Mm-hmm. And it's only comes out around the back or around the chest and stops in midline because it's coming out of that particular nerve root and that dermatome.
And then what would you recommend if one of our pediatric practitioner listeners, if they see a child who they think has shingles, what do you do next?
Well, you treat them. You know, there are some antivirals that may be beneficial, but most people just, unfortunately, kind of suffer through it.
So pain medication?
Yeah.
Well,
some people use acyclovir, but that'd be a question for the infectious disease expert. They would know that information a bit better than I do.
Well, Dr. Brooks, and of course, you see patients at University Hospital and at UT Health San Antonio. It's so insightful talking to you. I feel like the new asthma guidelines, they're kind of like reading Shakespeare as opposed to watching or listening to Shakespeare. It's much more, it makes a lot more sense listening to you say it.
Yeah, I think there's some, you know, the way they're written, of course, is very pedantic, if you will, and very specific because it was guided by the very specific clinical trials that were conducted in the right way. And the way we practice it, though, is a little bit different.
Yeah, it almost seems like more punchy writing where it's these are the top, you know, five things to do. This is the biggest change, you know, but.
Yeah, I think that was the sort of, I was lucky because I was really passionate about this topic even before I was asked to be on the committee. And so I got to be on the subcommittee on the smart therapy and helped write most of the guidelines or the text that nobody probably will read, but that's okay. Reads like a scientific journal, not quoting the literature, but I think you can simplify it. And I think other papers have come out since with saying, oh, well, you can just use your regular steroid inhaler along with albuterol when you're having an exacerbation, you get the similar result. And that's what a lot of us have been doing for years.
And continue that smart therapy.
Right, right.
Well, Dr. Ed Brooks with the University of Texas Health Science Center, thank you so much for being here back on the show on Pediatrics Now.
Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Pediatrics Now. Click on the link for free credit if you're a practitioner. You can also email us with questions or episode ideas. That address is pediatricsnow@uthscsa.edu. We release a new episode every Friday. I'm Holly Waymont. I hope you can join us for our next episode.